Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you? How is Pretoria?
I'm well. Pretoria is sort of moist at this moment, which is charming. It is a welcome relief from sort of the occasional heat wave. But I'm also fundamentally on a sort of how am I level. I'm wondering why we have such a cheerful intro jingle when almost inescapably we talk about subjects that don't match that level of sort of string quartet optimism. So just, you know, editorial note, make of it what you will.
Well, I will say two things on that. One is that I've had over the years quite a few people complain about the jingle, how much they hate it. And secondly, if we don't laugh, we would cry. So I choose to laugh rather than to cry. We're also joined today by Anlu Kiewa. Anlu, how are you doing?
Well, Nicholas, I'm still laughing and not crying, so doing well, thank you. Good to be back.
Very good to have you back. Okay. A very big problem in South Africa, particularly in recent years, has been the strengthening and domination of so much of the economy and society by organized crime. There was a project that's currently ongoing by News24 looking into the enormously widespread problem of extortion, particularly of small businesses, particularly in poor areas, but kind of almost everywhere in South Africa gets affected by extortion to some degree, from the biggest mines to the smallest spaza shop. Gangs are responsible for huge numbers of murders, particularly in the Western Cape and also in some parts of Gauteng. And we also have issues like these occasional blocking of highways to burn trucks. We have mafias operating everywhere from water to the construction industry, and you begin to wonder, well, you know, why is the mafia problem so out of control? Doesn't the police have a crime intelligence unit which is supposed to look into exactly these sort of things? And I think anyone who knows anything about the South African Police Service knows that its crime intelligence is not working particularly well, but there's an interesting media report here just about how badly the internal situation in the crime intelligence division of the state is. The headline on the story was "Night of the Long Knives of Crime Intelligence with Spook Outfit Mired in Purge and Capture Claims." And it goes on to detail a fairly confusing and complicated story, which I will just give some of the details of here. I won't go through all of them, but one of the incidents is that the crime intelligence unit has a slush fund, which is a secret fund used to fund covert police operations. The head of that is a guy called Hlungwani. He got into a bit of a dispute with his superiors when in 2017 he blocked the spending of 45 million rand on an eavesdropping device known as a grabber just a few days before the ANC's NASREC elective conference. It is widely speculated that this was effectively being used as cover for a money laundering scheme to buy votes at that elective conference. After halting the deal and then making a protected disclosure of corruption against high-ranking officers above him, Officer Hlungwani ended up being placed on paid suspension for 6 years on charges of various things. For example, he was accused of harassing his co-workers and a variety of criminal charges, which have all gone kind of nowhere. And he's been fighting this on paid suspension for the last, you know, since 2017, basically. 3 months ago, his salary was cut by his superiors, and he's now in court fighting over that. His main opponent at the moment is a senior police official called with the surname Kumalo, who was close to Bheki Cele and was appointed as the head of crime intelligence just before Bheki Cele was out of the position in the police ministry. And apparently those two are quite close. Kumalo previously headed up the political killings task team, which has not done a great job at preventing political killings in South Africa.
assuming that preventing them, assuming that preventing them was the mandate. I mean, yes, you never know. That's my permanent question on the issue of crime intelligence. Which way does the intelligence flow? It's sort of like headache pills and baby powder. What exactly is the description trying to position the word as? But never mind, as you were, right?
Indeed. So anyway, this is just a snapshot of some of the massive disputes going on within this organization that have effectively, it seems, really crippled the organization. I don't really know how exactly you're supposed to be tracking down mafias if everyone is in court with everyone else. Herman, why don't you start us off with some thoughts on what this story tells us and maybe how we can get to fixing it?
Well, you didn't mention my favorite detail of the entire article, and I'll quickly read it. It's quite brief. In March, Brigadier Dennis Chilly, a 38-year police veteran who had headed the Crime Intelligence Legal Services Department for 9 years, was dismissed for misconduct over his alleged shoplifting of an air fryer 6 months prior. So I just thought that was charming. It sort of brings the story to a level of human relatability, because who among us have not had the urge to shoplift an air fryer? So it just humanizes these people. It helps us understand their plight. But so I think the problem here is it genuinely boggles the mind how fundamentally rotten these entities are that are so vague. I think we've lost Lorimer to a laughing fit, but I mean, it might be crying. But it illustrates that these shadowy organizations that formed such a muscle part of the Zuma state capture apparatus is still, you know, in desperate need of reform. And when we say desperate need of reform, I mean, it could mean anything at this stage. We are blessed in the sense that we do not have a police state, even though I'm sure some people would want a police state. We don't have one, just simply, I think, because of police incompetence. So that is a blessing. If they wanted to tap citizens' phones, they might not be able to do so because the system might be down. Now, the problem that arises from this is, how do you start from scratch? And it really is quite difficult, because firstly, we just need to call out cadre deployment. We need to call out the fact that the institutions of state have just become ANC outcrops, which is, you know, ridiculous. That is why we have that 45 million rand nonsense at NASREC that is so overtly political. It is just astounding. And the fact that we still have cadre deployment, I mean, this is the result. This is the sort of part of the result of that. Then the second thing is, these budgets need to be under control. Where does that 45 million rand come from? You and me, from taxpayers, from people who've paid. If you've paid VAT, you've probably contributed to a few million being wasted by these intelligence services, you know, rather ironically and wittily named thus. So we do need to get back to a point where spending is gotten under control. And yet there's this crisis in South Africa that our economy is really undermined by the rule of law just being absent. We can see that with the Zama Zamas. And if we look back at the July 2021 riots, proper crime intelligence should have seen that coming. That took a level of coordination and planning, the sort of the main negative actors there, that any crime intelligence unit worth their salt would have been able to pick up, mobilize, and anticipate to thwart. And yet it didn't. So either it was politicized or it was incompetent. And in both cases, it doesn't bode well. So the route forward from this would possibly be just to fire the lot of them. I know that isn't, you know, very labor law specific, but at some point I just can't get past, where do we go from here without pressing the nuclear button? Well,
One does feel as though if you had a halfway competent manager with political backing in the top of those organizations, that they would, within about 2 months find a reason to dismiss almost every other senior official if they were focusing on it.
And I think that's the core thing. It's that political will. It is that political will that it hasn't existed now. I'm not sure if it exists now with the presidency being escalated in terms of its national intelligence position to a new level where it isn't truly accountable. Perhaps the establishment of some presidency oversight mechanisms in parliament is the way to go. But my word, reading this story was what depressed me and what made me sort of quite angry at the Soweto String Quartet as we started the show, because I was just like, put down the violin. We've got spies stealing air fryers. We've got, let's put it into context.
Yeah, I will also just say that I've just done a quick Google search and apparently you can get an air fryer for about 700 Rand, which, maybe you don't have to use, I'm not that great with money, but I'm pretty sure that if I was a senior police official, I could afford 700 Rand worth of air fryer. Anyway, Anlu, what do you make of all this? I mean, there's so many problems in South Africa you can draw back to the breakdown of law and order. It definitely contributes to our depressed economic growth. There are many factors that contribute to that, but, as Herman was saying, the kind of breakdown of law and order is one of those. It of course, crime, murders, just general unsafety, difficulty of attracting foreign immigrants with skills, all those sort of things are affected by crime. But then, you've also got zamas and logistics problems and stuff, which are all exacerbated by failures, essentially, at the end of the day, of crime intelligence in particular. What are your thoughts on this issue, just generally?
Yeah, well, I think Herman summarized it quite nicely. It feels like one of those stories where you continue reading and you think, surely this is as bad as it can be. And then you read the next paragraph. And I do apologize. I have to just show you how I read it. So I'd wear my glasses and reading, I'd go like, are you sure? Is this what I am reading? And that's honestly what it felt like. It felt like every time I read the next paragraph, it's just so much worse. And I want to draw specific attention to two of the accusations against General Khumalo, which was firstly that he doesn't have a valid clearance, security clearance. And I think before I move on to the next one, I think just quickly mentioning that this is one of the problems of cadre deployment is we see that. So he was very clearly very close to the previous minister, Bekele. So there's obviously a hand in appointments. As far as I understand, he didn't even have an interview for his appointment, which is a major concern. And then, of course, the second thing, which also draws back to this point, is the fact that he doesn't have any previous crime intelligence experience. And if we are to correct what is wrong here, it's as you said, Nicholas, we need competent people at the top. And these people will then hopefully, I'm not saying that it is the full solution. There's obviously a lot of the things that need to happen from the bottom up, but it will at least put in some sort of layer at the top, I believe, some sort of ceiling to where it can escalate to. And I think in this case specifically, one would hope that so we're already in the middle of the purge, as the article said, we're already in the middle of the conflict here. What now has to happen is I'd like to see actually, okay, so if somebody, if I can't remember the second party in question here, but whoever was right, we'd hope that the courts would be able to look at it independently. And if the person who was, in this case, the whistleblower, that they actually be reinstated. There's obviously something that we want to keep from them in the police service. And then in this case, if General Khumalo was wrong for him to then obviously, go through the correct processes. But the same problem is in the courts as we have in the security force. So, yeah, it's one big mess.
Nick, can I quickly add something very small?
Go ahead.
I know someone who recently handed in a government tender application. And when this person handed in that application, the person receiving that tender application didn't want to sign the register saying that they had received this tender. Usually, he said, people just put it in the box over there. It's at that level where the rot sets in the sense that even at the most basic fundamental level, where you need some acknowledgement that a tender application has been successfully submitted, you don't even have that basic level of competence. You don't even have someone willing to sign a piece of paper. So fundamentally, they are unsuited to even such a mundane menial task. But it is at that level where the rot creeps in, because if you can't even police the most basic processes of seeing is documentation appropriately received, then corruption can come in, then maladministration can come in, then spending can come in. So it's a problem so massive that if you try to start seizing it as a whole, I think you can get lost in the weeds so easily. And it's at this level that the idiocy of failure is going to become so difficult to roll back. Because these people are now entrenched in a system that pays well. They don't really have alternative skills to offer in a competitive market. So how do you get them out? And I hope there's political will there somewhere. And perhaps we can get the Glynis-Breitenbach treatment for some of the officials here. Because I must say, one of the most wonderful parliamentary moments of the last few years was just when that Tunney slapped about those G4S officials in that parliamentary committee hearing about the Thabo Bester escape. Oh, if we can just get some of that into this weedy nonsense, get a real prosecutorial person who writes about being shot at and sort of laughs about it. It's that toughness that has been rooted out in our law enforcement. And I suspect there might be just enough time left of these elements to be out there to reattract these skills, get the Willie Hofmeyers in there again, get the Glynis-Breitenbachs in there again, get perhaps Busi Pikole, but, you know, get the skills back that were eroded in the last 20 years. Then there might be a way back.
Yeah, I do feel as though, if one takes a proper systemic approach, things could improve rather quickly in some of these organizations. I think always about what our colleague Saragon says about how if you just follow the proper procedures and you make sure to document things and hold people to account and issue the correct warnings and things when people don't perform, you can discipline those who are not performing and encourage those who are to do their job properly. But even that most sort of basic level of management doesn't seem to be present at all in the crime intelligence system, which is just, an internal ANC battleground, it seems, for the most part. Although it does sound, who knows who exactly is telling the truth and all that, but it does sound here like Brigadier Hlungwani is at least definitely the more aggrieved party here, that he's been messed around by crime intelligence for blowing the whistle. Anyway, let's go on to our next story, and this one is kind of shockingly similar, and maybe we should have chosen a different one because it's so many of the same issues. But the Basic Education Department has been given, it's one of the most high profile departments given to the opposition, in this case the DA, to control in the Government of National Unity. But Herman, in our pre-show discussion, just described it a little bit as a bit of a hospital pass, and there's a reason for that. Our education outcomes are not particularly high. Despite the fact that we've lowered our pass rates for our matric, we have a very large number of people who still don't pass matric, or a much larger number who don't even get to matric. They drop out before they finish their schooling. We have very few students able to pass maths and science with sort of over 50%, which are quite useful benchmarks for the quality of education in general. And we still have problems like pit toilets and other infrastructure problems at schools across the country. Pit toilets in particular has been quite interesting to watch, because the new minister, Gwarube, has promised to eliminate them, I believe, by March or April next year, which is quite an ambitious target, and I definitely hope she succeeds. But this story was about the department. It comes from some information given to the media by the lobby group Equal Education, who've been talking about a target set at the beginning of this financial year by the Department of Basic Education to build 9 schools in areas in where the schools were of bad quality or didn't exist or that kind of thing. They've only managed 1 of those 9 schools that they plan to build. The one they did build was a replacement for a school that had been built out of inappropriate material. So I presume it was, you know, either bad prefab structure or maybe it was a sort of partial mud structure or something like that. The department has set, compared to this sort of track record, it set a fairly ambitious goal of 5.3 billion rand for the next sort of 3 years to replace 100 inappropriate and unsafe schools. At this rate, though, we'll maybe get 3 out of those 100, 4 out of those 100, if the department goes at this current rate. Anlu, it sounds like there's a lot of the same problems that have rotted crime intelligence here in the Department of Basic Education. And this is the challenge before the new minister, who, you know, is having to, on one hand, fight against the Bella Bill, which is not a policy she or her party agrees with. And at the same time, she also has to tackle the enormous amount of just kind of ineffectiveness in the department. What do you make of the story, Anlu?
Yeah, Nicholas, I agree with you that we probably should have picked another story because it's quite similar. I think what we see again is, as a result of planning happening, but planning not being put through, we continuously see targets being set, but no delivery on those targets. And then there's still underspending in many of these departments. What they want to make happen now, is that many of the school infrastructure grants, they want to combine into one big infrastructure grants for schools. And as far as I understand, it would then be the responsibility of the provincial education departments. And although it might help to some extent to not make it the basic education department's entirely their responsibility to have oversight over these different spending and allocation budgets. But the big problem here is that these provincial education departments they're notoriously undercapacitated. And the problem with that is that the progress they make is honestly at snail pace. For them to actually responsibly take over much of these allocations and the budgets and actually seeing these processes through, they would honestly have to first prove that they can actually do that. And I don't think that would happen. And then perhaps something that I can just draw attention to here is the fact that we see, I want to quote this from the article that you shared with us in advance. And it said that the poor education quality here and obviously the schools, it's serving as a stark reminder of the historical inequalities. And although I think, obviously, okay, it's fine. Yes, I understand that. But there is budget to actually build the new schools. And this is despite the budget being cut a little bit at the beginning of the year and again at the MTBPS in October. The problem here is that there's continuously a finger being pointed at something else instead of saying, okay, listen, we'll pick up the bricks and we'll build the schools. We'll stop the inefficient spending and the irregular spending, and we'll actually use the funds that we have to build the schools. So once again, it's one of those situations where can I just quickly mention this? Unfortunately, I can't remember the grant, the words for the acronym, but is it ACCISI? I'm probably just butchering it. But since the implementation of the oversight or the fund in 2011, there was only 337 schools built, which in your comparison, we'd see from 100 schools, we'll see probably 3. Astonishing.
Herman, what do you make of this one? I mean, this is, Anlu makes a great point there. This is the overwhelming problem in our education system. there are issues with not enough money sometimes. I know the Western Cape provincial government has complained about not being able to pay teachers' salaries recently, and so has had to reduce the number of teachers they have. But when there is money, it's just spent badly. And if we could eliminate the huge, huge amounts of waste and misspending in our budgets and just have a more effective and efficient government, we wouldn't be nearly so stressed for money in general. I don't know. What do you make of this, Simon?
Yeah, no, I agree. And the sad thing is, not one political party, I think, is really advocating a solution for this. And the solution seems to me rather obvious. In 2021, Solidariteit launched Soltec, a 300 million rand campus built under budget within a year in the aftermath of COVID, and they accomplished it. No state involvement, no state support that I could pick up on. So the idea that it's difficult to build a school. Yeah, fair enough, it's difficult to build a school, particularly, you know, I've never built a school personally, but, you know, it's clearly not impossible to do if you apply the right processes and just follow the procedure. And the real tragic thing here is if the IRR's voucher system was put in place, it'll solve this problem overnight. Because currently there's this obsession that if there's a problem in the education system, because it was caused by the government, it must also be solved by the government. So how would that work? Would we give more money? Well, that would, I think, be foolish, because we're already not getting bang for buck in terms of our education spending. As Nick, as you mentioned, in a country that has a financial services sector that is now responsible for beyond a quarter of employment, for every 1.2 million grade ones, we get about 50,000 matrics that pass mathematics with 50% plus. So we're in a situation where we're just not creating the talent and the skills necessary to just fire the engines of the economy currently. Get the government out of the way. There are few things on which I am as radically libertarian as it is on education. We have examples of private schools working. We have examples of township low fee private schools working, delivering successes. Our late great CEO, John Ken Berman, wrote an entire report on this a few years ago. Why the government should at all see it as their job to solve the problem that they've created frustrates me immensely. And I don't see a political party, not even the DA, who has this basic education portfolio, willing to be radical about how we restructure education in this country. If we took the few, 250 billion rand, I'm not sure what I think it must be around there, the education budget, of which, let's say, 200 of that goes to basic education budget. If we just convert that into school vouchers, give poor parents and people who can't afford private schooling the opportunity to let the money flow competent within money follow competence within the system, let the schools that actually deliver good outcomes receive the funding by the parents and the guardians of kids making those choices, you will solve this problem within a bloody year. It doesn't have to be this complex, but I will tell you, what's standing in the way of this is an ideological love of government intervention that I think is too prevalent in too many parties, and quite simply, vested interests. The teachers' unions and the public sector unions will not allow this to happen, because they know in a competitive market where they actually have to be remunerated on their skills rather than on their union membership, they are screwed. Now, I've spoken to township parents quite often, every now and again when the IRR publish something on education vouchers. Without fail, I get a few phone calls from township parents who ask, where can we get these vouchers? They sound amazing. And my heart breaks every time I have to explain that this is a proposal that the government, I can't give you the vouchers as much as I want to. This isn't a solution we want to see to a problem. And these people want the resources and the choice to send their kids to good schools, built schools, schools that aren't necessarily, you know, stuck somewhere in the patronage interest network of the Department of Very Basic Education. So just For once, if political parties, the GNU, and I know this is possibly an unfair challenge to Minister Gwahube, but how about we just get some boldness on policy? How about we look at charter schools around the world, free schools in the UK, and just allow
low-cost schools in India
to, for once, have the deciding low-cost schools in India. But, I mean, let's just try it. Let's just try it in the Northern Cape or in the Eastern Cape. Let's just try it, because what we're currently doing isn't working, and it is depressing as kids drowning in excrement.
No, exactly. I cannot really add anything to that. Amen. All right, very briefly, let's just talk about our last story today. And this is that Durban municipality, Etegwini municipality, has decided that it's just not going to be able to make the beaches as clean and pristine as they should be, particularly when you have the nice, warm Durban ocean and to be experienced. We had last year this problem where there was sewage and E. coli on the beaches of Etegwini. And this year, Etegwini has decided it's not even going to apply for the blue flag status, which is basically a certification that says that your beaches are clean and clear and good for swimming at. There are still described as in the news reporting as water quality challenges or problems, I think is a more accurate term, particularly, of course, high levels of E. coli. Now, you know, people shouldn't be drinking seawater, obviously, but ideally, you know, you want to have water that has almost no E. coli in order for it to be safe for people. A spokesperson for the city said the city had made the conscious decision after the devastating April 2022 floods not to participate in the Blue Flag program. That the floods had so severely damaged infrastructure, it would take a while to rehabilitate it. The spokesperson said the city has to date made significant progress in restoring infrastructure damage during the recurring flood disaster since April 2022. Well, you may have made some, but clearly not enough. And Durban is not a city right now that can afford to sacrifice even more of its economic opportunities, particularly tourism. Anlu, your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly that last point, Nicholas. That's exactly my thoughts. Durban can't afford this now. I think if you just look at a practical level, what we see is, so take for consider for just 1 minute, say businesses. Businesses can't actually prepare for the summer holiday. If it's a restaurant, they need to buy stock. If it's a hotel, they need to prepare their bookings and their rooms and their staff. And what we expect is generally, okay, Durban is a popular holiday spot. There's plenty of people that will head there. So businesses prepare, they buy extra stock to actually be prepared for the summer holiday. But the moment people start seeing reporting like this and they see, okay, perhaps it's not the best idea. So people who have other options, they perhaps might not, they simply decide to go to another holiday spot. And then they don't actually show up. So these businesses run significant losses. It affects tourism in the whole area. It affects businesses. It affects the locals. And at the end of the day, there's also less revenue then for them to actually fix many of the problems.
So Herman, one of our viewers asks, you know, how solvable is the issue of the beaches really? Sorry, I cut you off there for a second. Go ahead, Andrew.
No, that definitely wasn't you. It was certainly me. I apologize.
Are you back with us, Andrew? We seem to have lost her for a second. Okay, Herman, we got a question from the audience here asking, you know, how easily solvable is this problem? And I think this is a bigger issue. You know, it's not going to be easy to solve this overnight, because I think the backlog is pretty bad on this stuff. But this is connected to the larger problem of South Africa's failing water infrastructure, particularly in its big, I mean, the rural areas, the small towns across South Africa have had bad water problems for forever. But it's particularly getting to a crisis now because also the big cities also seem to be going the same way. So, you know, how do we actually start to solve this problem?
Well, I think it was Thomas Sowell who said that the problem with politicians is that they can make mistakes for which they do not pay the consequences. They do not experience the consequences of their mistakes. A very simple way, I think, to quite quickly see a turnaround in the quality of beaches in the Durban area is to allow businesses in the sectors that Anlu referred to, you know, your hospitality, tourism sectors, those businesses that really require visitors to the beach to operate and make a profit. Make a profit, by the way. Most of these businesses that are seasonal make losses for most of the year, and then during holiday seasons, they make up for those losses. So it's not like, oh, you know, December is a bad month, but at least we had a good November and we can look forward to the solid February or January. A very quick way to solve this is to simply introduce a tax write-off or a rate write-off. If you're a business that has an interest in a clean beach, in this sort of tourism, if you can show sufficient evidence that you have invested either by paying for a private service provider or by doing it yourself for a certain portion of a beach to be cleaned, for a certain part of the available water infrastructure to be rehabilitated, you get a massive discount on your rates and taxes. And that'll fix the problem overnight, because that'll make sure that the government won't need to spend uselessly on the type of environmental rehabilitation that they clearly are incapable of doing. And it'll put the resources of the government, or the ability of the government to exempt certain financial and taxational onuses on people, it'll put that to effective use. And you will see a change immediately, because these people have their livelihoods on the line. If the beaches and the water sources near Durban aren't actually sensible or healthy or safe for tourists to use, the politicians will feel no pain. They will lose nothing. But these businesses dependent on these areas, they will actually have an incentive to act. And if we could use that incentive, monetize that incentive, make it worth their while to do what they can to rehabilitate these areas, I think you'll see it within a year, you'll see a massive improvement. It's about how we think about the problems and who can really fix them. And there are options, of which this is one.
Indeed. Water engineering is a marvelous thing if it is done correctly and the money exists to spend on it. And you can actually do quite a lot to filter out water flows in cities. Also, you know, if the infrastructure in general is not leaking and not decaying, I know that Johannesburg's waterways, for example, are often filled with leaking sewage just simply because of old pipes and things that are broken. That can go a ways to reducing the impact on places like beaches and that kind of thing. So there's a lot that can be done if you have the right management strategy and political will. All right. Anyway, that is all the money, or sorry, all the time. I wish all the money we have due for today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we can't afford another minute of undo. That's the problem.
you can't be mean to people with bad internet, Herman, because then they don't have the opportunity to respond. Anyway, we'll see you all next week. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers.